KALW.
No tenía mucha seguridad en el trabajo porque la señora era agresiva.
She says the elderly woman was aggressive.
Fair and safe work environments aren't guaranteed for the people who do our most intimate caretaking.
There's an unwillingness in our culture to recognize domestic work as real work.
Today, how one caregiver's experience improved through community and collective action. Then experts say parental stress levels are at an all-time high.
Social media added a whole level of intensity to the challenges of parenting.
And a local publisher celebrates 50 years of printing books about California.
All we do is provide the conditions that enable people to tell their own stories.
Stories about the Golden State. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Domestic workers are people who work in private homes, like nannies, house cleaners, cooks, and caregivers. In California, most are immigrants and women of color. Not only is this work often undervalued, it's out of the public eye. The state isn't coming in to check that basic labor and safety laws are being met. So these kind of workers are vulnerable to a wide range of abuses. KLW's Wendy Reyes spent the day with a caregiver in San Jose organizing to improve her working conditions.
¿Cómo está, señora Gloria? Buenos días.
¿Usted?
Bien, señora Gloria.
Bueno.
Ya estoy aquí.
It's Wednesday morning, and Maria Elena is arriving to work in San Jose. For her, going to work means going to someone's home.
Entonces, ahorita voy a ir para su cuarto porque hay que tender su cama. Señora Gloria, ya está su cafecito.
Ya, ¿quiere que me vaya a sentar allá?
No, si quiere ahí se lo doy. Ahorita se viene a sentar acá cuando...
Maria Elena is Gloria and Rogelio's caregiver. She's been working with them for a year. She begins each morning the same, gives them their medicine, a protein shake, makes them coffee. Gloria sits in front of the TV while Rogelio retreats to his lawn chair in the front yard. Maria Elena heads to the kitchen table to pull out a well-worn notebook.
Pero casi siempre en este cuaderno hacemos hacemos anotaciones, por ejemplo.
She jots down what time she came in, what she fed Gloria and Rogelio, and any other notes related to her caregiving.
Puede ser que las personas a veces tienen demencia.
We have to document things like that at work, she says, because it may be that people sometimes have dementia, so sometimes they don't remember what they ate and if they were fed. Maria Elena has been doing this work for 14 years and has taken care of clients with various health needs like memory loss. The work is both strenuous and precarious. She tends to work with people towards the end of their lives, which often means dealing with death followed by unemployment. But for her last client, that ended differently.
Tenía otros clientes que tuvimos, tuve que parar el trabajo porque tenía... La señora tenía Alzheimer.
Maria Elena was taking care of another elderly couple. The woman had Alzheimer's.
Cuidadora solamente para su mamá. Entonces yo tuve que decirles que para mí era muy muy pesado. No tenía mucha seguridad en el trabajo porque la señora era agresiva.
She says the elderly woman was aggressive. The woman pulled on Maria Elena's hair once in the shower and strained Maria Elena's neck. At other times, the woman would start hitting her. This is common with people with dementia. If the patient lived in a skilled nursing facility, Maria Elena could call for backup or talk to her boss. But in this case, there was no backup, and her boss was the couple's children. The harm reached a personal breaking point one day when Maria Elena ran into traffic to retrieve the elderly woman who had wandered out of the home. When Maria Elena suggested they hire a second caregiver to allow for breaks to heal from injuries, the couple's daughter said no. The daughter said she could keep the job as is or leave. Maria Elena chose her safety and left.
Entonces preferí eso.
I preferred it this way, she says.
Porque yo necesitaba también cuidarme a mí misma para cuidarlos a ellos, ¿no?
I need to take care of myself in order to take care of them, she says. María Elena hasn't always felt this comfortable standing up for her rights.
Porque yo antes no... Si yo me sentaba, yo sentía que a lo mejor me iban a correr.
When she first started as a caregiver, she was afraid to take breaks. She feared she'd be seen as lazy and get fired. She didn't know then she was lawfully allowed to take rest breaks. So she'd work nonstop until she clocked out. A lot of domestic workers feel this way. It's the nature of the job.
It's a private relationship. It's in a private home. It's behind closed doors. And because of that uniqueness, they are exposed to many abuses.
That's Kimberly Alvarenga. She's the executive director of the California Domestic Workers Coalition in San Francisco. They're an umbrella organization for groups around the state that provides Know Your Rights trainings and organizing opportunities for domestic workers.
This is a workforce that is not all under one roof, that can't join a union because, you know, there aren't a number of workers under one roof that are going to be organized or can come together and have meetings.
The workers are primarily women of color and immigrants, often afraid to call any attention to themselves due to fear of retaliation. In California, domestic workers are entitled to labor laws related to pay, things like paid sick leave, overtime pay, minimum wage. But domestic workers who work independently outside of agencies are excluded from labor laws protecting their health and safety at work, meaning that employers aren't obligated to provide a safe workplace free of hazardous conditions. For someone like María Elena, hazardous working conditions can look like the dangers of lifting clients, which can be a heavy strain on caregivers' backs. Without proper training or lifting equipment, caregivers face injury and ultimately loss of their source of income. Domestic workers aren't guaranteed these health and safety protections. No one is going into homes to make sure standards are being met. And even for the rights domestic workers are guaranteed, wage theft and exploitation are rampant. And enforcement and education is a huge issue.
There's an unwillingness in our culture to recognize domestic work as real work.
The California Domestic Workers Coalition has been campaigning for policy change over the last several years. In 2023, Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a bill that would have given domestic workers those basic health and safety rights at work. The veto came out of a concern for homeowners' privacy. Inserting government enforcement in someone's house doesn't bode well with some folks. Kimberly says it was a huge blow to the coalition because they see a veto like that continuing to devalue the essential work domestic workers perform.
Their work actually is the work that makes all other work possible. And if it wasn't for their work, there are so many people out there that wouldn't be going anywhere to work without someone to care for the most valuable and precious things in our society, which is our homes, our elders, and our children.
Back at Gloria and Rogelio's house, it's time for María Elena's break. She knows it's her right to take one.
Pues bueno, voy a agarrar un break, señora Gloria.
¿Mandé?
Voy a agarrar un break.
Ándele.
Not only does María Elena know her rights, she now teaches other domestic workers about them. During the pandemic, she became a member of the California Domestic Workers Coalition.
Me llamó la atención porque siempre me gusta como involucrarme, ¿no? Y empecé ahí también.
She says, it caught my attention because I always like to get involved, right? They were a great help for many people and for me too. Because María Elena knows her rights, her work experience has improved. And until she's fully guaranteed a safe workplace by law, she's going to keep teaching others how to stay safe. In San Jose, I'm Wendy Reyes for Cross Currents.
Wendy is KALW's immigration reporter. You can hear more of her work at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Last August, the U.S. Surgeon General issued an advisory declaring that parental stress was now considered to be a major public health issue. The report shed light on increasing stress levels among parents, saying 33% of parents reported high levels of stress, and 48% of parents say most days their stress is completely overwhelming. Some of the stressors the report mentioned are economic, like financial strain or affording childcare. But parents also reported higher levels of loneliness and isolation, and many cited technology and social media as sources of stress. One Bay Area group that's been helping parents navigate all this is Family Paths. They have a 24-hour hotline parents can call when they're experiencing stress. I visited them in their Oakland office and sat down with Kim Sengabriel, program manager for the hotline, and Michael J. Lewis, a parent educator there. First, I asked Kim if the Surgeon General's report surprised her at all.
So, surprised in the sense that parenting stress is not usually something that's seen as a public health issue, and most of the time people don't really talk about it, right? Other than us. We talk about it all the time here. So to have the Surgeon General, like, to name this as an actual public health crisis, that's amazing. So surprised, but in a good way. Not surprised, and it's like, yeah, duh. Like, this has been going on for a really long time. Parents have always been stressed, and parenting is just getting harder and harder. And social media, that has added a whole level of intensity to the challenges of parenting. Because how do you monitor that? How do you, you know, allow young people to have access, but in a limited way? How do you protect them, not overprotect them? So there's so much. And, you know, kids and young folks are getting all kinds of crazy information, and they're getting, you know, targeted in ways that are really scary. And so, you know, parents, they're not supposed to know what to do with that. It's like when kids have serious mental health issues, parents are parents. They're not psychologists. They're not therapists. They're not specialists. They're supposed to just be parents. And we're not supposed to have to know what a, you know, diagnosis is and how to recognize it. And that's what the doctors are for. But I think parents feel like they are supposed to know that. Oh, I am supposed to know how to deal with this really hard thing without asking for help, without burdening anybody.
You have your helpline, which is 800-829-3777. Someone calls. Who picks up the phone and what happens?
So who picks up the phone when someone calls is a parent support counselor, either a professional parent support counselor or a volunteer that's trained. And the first thing is really listening to the caregiver that's calling. What is it they're calling about? Sometimes people are really upfront when they call. They're like, I'm calling because I need to sign up for a parenting class. I'm being court ordered to a parenting class. Now, in that process, there may be opportunities to go a little deeper in the call and ask a little bit more about how they're doing. How are you coping? Oh, so you haven't been able to see your kids for how long? For 2 months? Wow, that must be really hard on you. How are you coping with that? And, you know, if the person takes that opening and walks through the door with you, then we'll have that conversation. Caregivers and parents, they have the answers in themselves most of the time. What happens is people get stressed, prefrontal cortex goes offline, and they're kind of being ruled by their amygdala, which is like fight, flight, and they can't think clearly when there's like a immediate stressor with their child, right? Or the stressors at work or with their partner, whatever, but they're not able to think clearly. So our goal would be to help that person get back in touch with their kind of inner knowledge. So prefrontal cortex comes back online, and let's talk about, you know, what have you done in the past? What has worked?
What are you hearing most from the dads? What concerns? What questions?
Oh, man. I mean, the child support system, I have a lot of fathers that come in with that. They want to find out, wanting to have that time with your children and not being allowed that and also being charged that. So it's like, I have to make more money to take care of myself and my child. But if I make more money, you're going to take more money. So I'm right back in the same situation. I lose time, but I'm working harder. I'm making less. Sometimes, even though we have friends and we have people that we can find, and they ain't the best people to help us, tell us where to go and what to do, right? Like, it could be the blind leading the blind. So then sometimes not feeling comfortable to ask for that type of support, right? And so being able to know who and where to ask for that type of support is, again, something else that contributes to the overall idea of healthy parenting.
One thing that they mentioned in this report was about this culture of comparison, that parents feel like they are being compared with other parents. And to me, you know, I'm like, yeah, it's been happening, but there's something that is new. Could it be social media? We're in this new world where whatever you do is on Instagram, it's on TikTok, and your friends are seeing it, and your, you know, circles are seeing it. Can that be a reason?
Yes. Now we have the ability to be able to see what everybody else is doing or what they want us to see that they're doing. So, you know, that picture of the family at the great vacation spot or their kid, you know, graduating with honors and about to start school at, you know, whatever the thing is now public and everybody can see it, which means I'm seeing it as a parent, and it's like, oh, well, they're doing all of this, so I should be doing all of this for my kids. Mm-hmm. Trying to keep up with what everybody else is doing and the expectations that, oh, your kids should be in these extracurriculars and they should be performing this way, and you as a parent should be, like, scheduling their every moment. Mm-hmm. Like, Monday through Friday, they should have this schedule, that schedule, and they shouldn't, you know, come home until dinner time with multiple things to do because you're building their, like, CV, their resume for the next thing.
You've talked about the work and what you do. What does this mean for you personally, that you are doing this work? And that you're helping families, you're helping mothers and fathers and caregivers in this way, that this is what you do. What does that mean for you personally?
Oh, man, you're going to hit me in the feels. oh, yeah, it feels good. It's emotional, just in the fact that I know for some parents, I've had a mother that she found out, like, class, well, how long the class said? 2 hours. 2 hours. She started off coming in there and, you know, getting her to loosen up and be, take it as, like, now she's not as worried about the time. And now she see that I'm more, because I teach my class, I'm funny, I'm animated. I like to do that. Like, I got to be here 2 hours to teaching. But I say that to say, like, having a parent that like that in the beginning, and then at the end of the class, she's hanging around a little bit later. I said, I'm here for a few more minutes. Anybody want to talk to me? She hangs around and says, you know what? It's like therapy. I was like, oh, word? Okay, well, I'm not a therapist, but I can understand how therapeutic and cathartic it can be to actually be able to talk to somebody.
That's Kim Sangabriel, program manager for the Parental Stress Hotline, and Michael J. Lewis, a parent educator at Family Paths in Oakland. You can call the hotline if you need it. It's 800-829-3777. We'll have all their resources up at klw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Heyday Books, a nonprofit publisher in Berkeley that was founded by Malcolm Margolin. Heyday is known for releasing a wide range of books relating to California, including nature, history, and poetry. Malcolm retired in 2016, and he passed the publishing torch to Steve Wasserman. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with Steve about Heyday's literary legacy.
Steve Wasserman, welcome.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Congratulations on Hay Day turning 50.
Thanks so much. It's a very auspicious golden anniversary.
So what was it like for you stepping into the big shoes of Hay Day founder Malcolm R. Golan after he stepped down?
Well, Malcolm retired in 2015, 2016, at the age of 75, less for reasons of the advance of age. He'd founded the company in 1974. And for 40 years, it reflected his sensibility. But he stepped away from the job because biology in the disobliging form of Parkinson's was tapping him on the shoulder. And he was enough of a wise soul to know that, you know, maybe it's time that somewhat younger ought to step into the post to help write the second chapter of this independent publishing company. I had known him for about 25 years, and I always admired what he did with very few resources, but a tremendous imagination and a nimble sensibility that tried to vivify this strange place called California with all its contradictions, all its ironies, all its paradoxes, and its diverse set of communities. I admired it greatly. So when the word went out that Malcolm was going to retire, I rang him up and I said, if I threw my hat in the ring, would you give me some encouragement? Or would you tell me, don't even think about it? And to my surprise, he said, yes, that would be a wonderful idea.
Over 50 years, you all have put out over 500 books.
Yes.
I believe. So what books have been most impactful, would you say?
Well, I think there's a book called Bad Indians by Deborah Miranda, which is now assigned reading in college courses all over the country. I would say certain memoirs, particularly from voices that have been neglected or overlooked, we have championed those voices, and they have really struck a chord, an echo of enthusiasm, not only in similarly neglected communities, but others as well who want to broaden their horizons. Our nature titles have been extraordinarily popular. We, a few years ago, published something called the California Field Atlas by Obi Kaufman. And we operate also a magazine for the last 37 years called News from Native California. We publish it, but it is entirely in the hands of Native people. Its editor is Taria Smith, who is a member of our staff, and she's a member of one of California's tribes. And all we do is provide the conditions that enable people to tell their own stories in their own words.
And I understand you have a book out, Hay Day does, called Hay Day at 50, Selections from 5 Decades of Independent Publishing, so people can read this different essays or samples of some of the work that you all have put out over the last 50 years. And you also have, you, Steve, have a book. And for those listening, Steve is a great storyteller, as you can hear. And so he has a book called Tell Me Something, Tell Me Anything, Even If It's a Lie. What is that about? I was joking with you. I was like, this sounds like a relationship book, but I know it's not. Steve is a serious journalist and publisher.
Oh, I mean, it's leavened by some levity here. It's comprised of 30 essays. They were originally, most of them, published in diverse publications such as The Village Voice and The Los Angeles Times, The Nation and The New Republic, among others. And they really try to trace the story of what I hope is an empathetic sensibility and the awakening of what I hope is a lively mind. And taken together, these essays are an attempt to reveal the depth and breadth of my enthusiasms, and they range over politics, literature, and the tumults of a world in upheaval. And they include stories of the bookstore owner who wouldn't let me buy the books I wanted, because, just to give away the story, when I approached him with the books I wanted to buy, and he looks at the books and he looks at me and he says, I can't sell them to you. And I look at him, I say, well, you won't take a credit card, or you know, I think I have enough cash to buy them. And he says, no, I'm so sorry, I can't sell these books to you at all. And I said, for heaven's sake, why not? And he looks at me and he says, without a trace of irony, you're not ready.
Wait a minute, hold on. What are the books about?
Who knows what I don't even remember what the book. There was maybe a book of poetry, a book of philosophy. I wasn't yet ready, according to this guy. So I tell that story. I also tell the story of in 1968, when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in April of 68, a very close friend of mine named Ronnie Stevenson, who was an early recruit and member of the Black Panther Party, and he had established the Black Student Union at Berkeley High School. He was the first chair of that. Together, we led a student strike of about 2,000 kids. He organized the African-American kids. I organized the white kids. Together, we marched out of the school under the banner of a single demand, which was to establish an African-American history and studies department. To our astonishment, we won.
So, okay, Heyday, 50 years old. What's your vision, Steve, going forward for the next 50 years?
To make sure that Heyday is not the best kept publishing secret in the great state of California and indeed in the country.
That was Heyday Books publisher Steve Wasserman speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Steve's book is Tell Me Something, Tell Me Anything, Even If It's a Lie. That interview is co-produced by Sarah Jesse and Porfirio Rangel. Today's Cross Currents team includes Yosmai Del Maso, Anthony Ivey, Aaron Lim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salier, Shirin Adil, Anisha Herjani, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.